This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Roseanne Arnold, may have one of the most public, private lives in show business. Now she has a new memoir that tries to bring together all the seemingly contradictory sides of her personality. It's called My Lives. This has been a big week for her. The book is out. Her husband Tom's new show premiered last night. And the night before, ABC broadcast a controversial episode of Roseanne. When the episode opens, Roseanne and her sister meet Nancy's new girlfriend Sharon, played by guest star Mariel Hemingway. The couple invites Roseanne and Jackie to come with them to a gay bar. And at the bar, Sharon gives Roseanne a big kiss. I asked Roseanne if it was her idea to set an episode in a gay bar.
That was my husband's idea. The whole episode was Tom's idea. I didn't want to do it.
Why didn't you want to do it?
Well, because I was thinking, I didn't know if it was appropriate or not. And I felt it was going to be big controversy, and I didn't know if I wanted to get into that. But once my husband was into it, he went to the network and gave them the outline, and they said no. So he ordered a script done anyway, and they said no to the script. And then he filmed the show anyway, and they said no to that. And then he kind of politicked, and it's because of my husband that it was on the air, and it's because of him that I did it. And now I'm really, really proud that I did, and I feel it was an important show and an important subject to tackle. I didn't feel too much of the controversy. I thought everybody was pretty much on our side, and that was nice.
Was there a lot of controversy between how the kiss should be shot and what should be shown and what angle and this and that?
No, my husband did that, mm-hmm. And you know, we would never hopefully insult our audience on purpose anyway, or be prurient or pander. So we just did it, I think, in the best non-lurid way that we could.
There are two gay characters who are regulars on the show, the characters played by Martin Mull and Sandra Bernhardt.
Yeah.
Was there ever a problem with that? Were you ever told that would be too controversial or that some of the viewers would be offended by it? Did you have to fight for that, is what I'm asking?
Yeah, we did. And my husband, Tom, he did most of that. I wanted to have the gay characters and wanted them to not be caricatured. And I wanted them to have, like, you know, loving relationships and, like, be normal human beings instead of, you know, some other shows that have gay people that just sit in their rooms and get beat up. And so we wanted to show that. And, yeah, it was a little bit of a lot of bustle, but people there, they like to make a big deal over little things, and then they end up doing what you want usually anyway. But they first go to the press and stir everything up. I think they do that so people will watch. And I'm not a fan of that technique, but that's the business I'm in.
Roseanne Arnold is my guest. She has a new memoir called My Lives. Now, on the acknowledgments page, you thank your doctors.
Yeah.
Not a typical acknowledgement type of thank you. Why'd you thank them?
Because they have helped me so much.
What kind of doctors?
Oh, all kinds. Psychiatrists mostly.
And you thank my dolls. And I wasn't sure whether that was an affectionate term for real people in your life or whether you collect dolls.
I have a doll, rather large doll collection of probably over 200 dolls. And I pick each one of them because they remind me of a part of me, and I have them all arranged in a great big circle around the desk where I write, circle after circle, a small circle, then a bigger one, and then a bigger one, and then a bigger one, and they totally ring the room. And I like to go in there and turn the lights low and listen to music and just look at the dolls, and it's calming, I guess, like some people have fish tanks for that.
They
have given me a lot of good feelings.
Uh-huh. Let me do a little bit of Roseanne, the early years.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Predominantly Mormon area. But you're from a Jewish family.
Yes, but I was raised as a Mormon.
Well, how did your family end up in Salt Lake City?
Actually.
How did your family end up in Salt Lake City?
Well, they were merchants, and they came there because it was a time of a bustling boom town, copper mines and this and that and the other, and they were merchants, so they went to where the business was, from Kansas City and from Minneapolis.
Now, your father ended up selling crucifixes door-to-door, not a typical profession for a Jewish man.
Yeah.
How did he end up doing that?
Well, he and my grandfather, it was my grandfather's, they were kind of, I guess, a con man, and they did the door-to-door scam thing. Like, for an extra $5, my grandfather would bless their holy water. He told them he was a Greek holy man, and they believed him. And one time they asked my dad, how come your father's Greek, but you're Jewish? And my father said, I converted. But they were just kind of flim-flam men, but that's how they made their living, with selling crosses and 3D pictures of Jesus that when you walked by him, his eyes closed, or else first he was standing real nice in a robe, and then when you walked by, he'd get crucified. The two things go flash back and forth.
So did you have a lot of that in your house?
Oh, yeah, we had those things everywhere. All the things they sold were all through the house. I used to look at those pictures and get really scared.
Well, that's the funny thing. There's so much of that, of, you know, like biblical art and pictures of Jesus on the cross that really terrify kids.
Oh, yeah. Well, it terrified me because I didn't hear of him till I was older. I didn't hear who that guy was.
You didn't know that this was Jesus?
No. I didn't know who the hell it was.
So you thought this was just like some guy who was being terribly punished?
Yeah, I thought, uh-oh, you better stay in line because you never know what could happen to you.
My guest is Roseanne Arnold. She's written a new memoir called My Lives. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Roseanne Arnold is my guest. She has a new memoir called My Lives. You left home when you were, what, 18? Or how old were you when you left home?
Well, when I left home for good, I was about 18, yeah.
And you went to Denver.
Yeah.
Worked at a feminist bookstore.
Well, that was way later.
Oh, that was way later?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. I went to Denver to have a baby who I gave up for adoption.
Right. This was, I think you've written that the first time you had sex, you got pregnant.
Yeah.
So you gave up the baby for adoption.
Yeah.
A child who you later met when she turned
18. Yeah, 5 years ago. We were reunited.
Did you think, oh, my life is over now, when you got pregnant? Because that's, you know, I know I grew up on those movies where when the teenager gets pregnant and she's not married and she isn't going to be married in the near future, it's shame and it's the end.
Well, there was a lot of shame to it for my family. My father spit on me, and they acted as if I had shamed them in a neighborhood where... You know, pretty much everybody was either a drunk or some kind of weirdo, and I didn't understand that. But so I did not want to have that baby around them, and I didn't feel that I had any help there or any way to do it, or I would have kept her. And I did try to, but I had no way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel it was the end of my life. I guess I have always known somewhere that I was going to, you know, be successful someday and have a lot of money, and I knew I'd be famous too, I think.
So how did you start working at a feminist bookstore in Denver?
Actually, it was my sister that got me involved in it. She went to this bookstore for a support group for lesbianism support group. She was just coming out, and so I, you know, went over there with her, and I ended up to. I think there was a couple other straight women there, and I thought it was a cool place because it had all these books, and I've always loved books, and it had books written by women from all over the world, every culture. It was just so cool, and I got involved because of the books and because it was a reference place where people called and said, where can I go to find this kind of help? And, you know, it was something I did for a few hours a day for free, you know, in a collective, and then it got more and more. I got more and more involved in it as it went along, and until I began to do stand-up.
Was there a connection between the bookstore and getting involved in stand-up?
Oh, absolutely.
What was it?
Well, it was all the feminist theory and stuff that I was reading. I was like, my God, people don't know this. People do not know this. They've never heard this. It's kind of censored. It's secret stuff. It's sinister wisdom. And I thought, well, I want to find a way to bring it mainstream, to bring it to everybody. And so my comedy came out of that.
How did you develop your early domestic goddess idea? You know, that you didn't want to be called a housewife or a homemaker. You were a domestic goddess.
Well, it actually came from this book called Fascinating Womanhood by Helen B. Andelin, which my mother was reading sometime in the 60s. And I opened it to this chapter that was entitled Domestic Goddess. And it was telling you how to be a domestic goddess so that, you know, your husband would buy you a toaster or whatever, you know. And, you know, it's kind of preceded the wrapping and saran wrap total woman thing. So you're supposed to keep your house really clean and, you know, then your husband would treat you better or something. Domestic goddess. I thought it was so funny. I'd always loved that name. So that's when I said it was like kind of like somebody who, what I had in my head was that I would say it like somebody who really didn't get what it means but thought it meant something else. And that's what really clicked with a lot of people.
And how did the rest of your act start falling into place?
Well, once I got the domestic goddess part, that was like the context, and then I just began to write jokes that filled in that context and stayed within that persona.
What I often think about some comics is that the stuff that makes them insecure in real life, they can really use to their advantage on the stage. Was it that way with you?
I guess in some way, I don't know. I thought mine was more of a mission for women.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was on a mission from God to save women and to enlighten them for feminism in the beginning.
Well, how'd you go over?
So I didn't think it was just me, or else I wouldn't have had the guts to do it.
Well, how'd you go over in the clubs in the early days?
Well, the first time I ever went on stage, I did really well. I'd had a very political act then. It was not the domestic goddess act. And the second time I went on stage, people just freaked out and were booing me. And one woman turned her chair around so that her back was towards me. And so I thought, well. And then I got kicked out of this clubs. They wouldn't let me perform. So I had to go perform at these punk bars and coffee houses and Unitarian churches and all these alternate places to perform. And now looking back, you know, I'm really glad that I did, that I didn't have to give into that club mentality because, you know, otherwise my act would be like everyone else's is, and their acts are all pretty much the same. But I got to develop in biker bars and gay bars and punk bars, and you know, they'd just throw me out in the middle of the crowd with no microphone in the punk bar, surrounded by kids slam dancing, and I'd have to figure out a way to get them to listen to me, and I did, and I learned a lot of things, you know, from getting to have those experiences that I probably would not have learned in the regular clubs.
No, could you use the same material in a biker bar as in a gay bar, as in a punk bar?
I learned how to do that. I learned how to do that, and that was another thing that I'm grateful for because I really learned to speak a lot of different languages to a lot of different groups of people, and I think that that also shows in my show, that I have brought that to the show, and that's why it has such a great cross-current of people who watch.
You write in your new book, My Lives, that during the period you were working in the feminist bookstore and starting to do stand-up, you were also working the streets and picking up audience members for sex and money. Now, how did that connect with the feminist part of your life, if you were picking up people and paying, you know, charging them for sex?
Have you read my book?
Yeah.
My book is about the various parts of me, and that is, I was also, that chapter you're quoting from, I was also then going home and, you know, being a housewife and a mother and making dinner every night and writing for a heavy metal magazine and doing a couple other really way out there things. That's how I have always lived my life because there are many, many different parts inside of me who were until recently unaware of each other.
So you're saying these things didn't connect? That you
No,
had,
they didn't connect at all.
You had very contradictory personalities.
Absolutely, just like being a Jew and a Mormon didn't connect. I think, really, that was one of my first splits.
So what paid more for you, charging for sex or doing your act at comedy clubs?
Charging for sex. I had to do the comedy clubs for free for a while. Uh-huh. So that's why I don't really know why I did that, but I liked that I was chasing men out of the feminist bookstore with a baseball bat and then changing in my car in the back and then going walking down four blocks to hustle them. I mean, that's how horribly frightening my life was and how out of control everything was and how foreign everything was.
You write that sex became the most horrifying and disgusting thing in the world to you. Did it stop being that way when you stopped charging for it?
No, why I said that was because that was when my younger sister Stephanie called me from Salt Lake City and told me that our father had molested her. And that is when I started to act out sexually.
Mm-hmm.
But ironically, I still did not have the memories of my own sexual abuse for 10 more years. But I was acting out sexually right after that when Stephanie, I said, get on a plane and come here. And she moved into my house in Denver when she was 17, and my mother signed over legal guardianship to me because she did not want her home either. And, so then my mother and father could pretend that things had not happened. And Stephanie came to live with me for about 2 years, and then my other sister came also.
I want to get back to your performing. When you were given the opportunity to do a show and to base it on the persona that you'd created for your act, how did you want it to extend the kind of Roseanne personality into a sitcom? What was your vision of what that character should be?
Well, I wanted it to be the very same thing, just an outgrowth. And instead of telling stories about my three kids and my husband, I would show them.
Were there things that bugged you about the way mothers or wives or the working class or women in general had been portrayed on TV series?
Oh, yes, all of the above, and that's why I wanted to do what I do now, for exactly those reasons.
Did you have, like, particular things that really got to you, that particularly annoyed you, that you saw a lot on TV?
Well, everything you just said, either mother was absent or she was an idiot and a total, like, enabler and nothing else, had no life, no mind, or she was dead. It was just so Disneyland and fairy tale and so white, and there was no class, and there was never any issues about class on television, which was funny because the big majority of people who watch television are working class, and that was never addressed, and everything was all pretending to be about striving to be. Come and have middle-class values and middle-class lives. And I wanted a show that made fun of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so totally ridiculous to think that someone works as a waitress and lives in a great big house with, it was all a lie.
I think it's fair to say that for the most part on TV, fat people have been played for laughs, the buffoon. Was it really important to you
to be fat? Not really.
Well, not to be fat, but to be who you were and not be played for laughs because of your weight.
I never thought that was relevant at all. It was totally irrelevant to me because I had been fat and thin, and it never was any different either one.
Your self-image wasn't changed either way?
No, right? Nothing in the world changed either way. And I thought, when first people were, some of the first things that came out about the show was that, oh, this is a show about fat people. And that always kind of amazed me to how low the common denominator goes as far as people, what they get. But I just let it sit there because some people get things when they need to get things, and they get things on the level that they themselves think on. So to some people, it is just a show about fat people.
How would you sum up what it's about?
Well, it's a show about class,
mm-hmm.
and women.
The interesting thing to me is that as you have gotten more and more successful, I mean wildly successful, your life has gotten further and further away from the life of the Roseanne character in the TV series. Yeah, I mean,
how do you know that?
Well, I mean, when you make the kind of money you make, you can no longer be working class. You can be working, but you can't be working class.
Well, does that just mean that? Well, does working class just mean how much money you make? See, that's part of the whole class issue that I want to talk about and address, because that is not true.
To what if it isn't about your life is?
It is a culture, and uh-huh. that is the culture I was raised in, uh-huh. and that's the culture I portray and will always be a part of, no matter what. Because that's where I came from, and it's who I am.
But still, though, I mean, your life really has become very different from the Roseanne character's life, in the sense that she has to worry about making ends meet and starting a business, periods of unemployment, and stuff like that.
So do I.
Making ends meet?
Yes. Of course. I have a big mortgage and a big house, but I still have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just because it's bigger doesn't mean that all that stuff is gone. And I do have to worry about work and how long it will last and if I'll work again after the show. And, you know, I have the same worries as anybody else, and so do all rich people, and that's just totally ridiculous.
I'm wondering, when you married Tom Arnold and you later decided to change your name,
uh-huh.
I'm wondering why you decided to change your name. And I ask that because, first of all, a lot of women don't do it in general anymore, mm-hmm. but usually particularly women in show business whose name has become their public name, even if they change their name in private, they often keep their name in public.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting decision on your part. And I'm wondering what was behind it.
I would prefer to have my husband's than my father's, because I don't like my father. And I do not like that family, and I don't like that name. And I wanted that period of my life to be over, so when I changed my name to Arnold, I joined a new family.
Roseanne Arnold, she's written a new memoir called My Lives. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.